Just to start, it's been less than a week than the from the violence on the Capitol. How are you, and what's the mood like up there?
I think everybody's still in somewhat of a state of shock. No one ever expected to see an assault on the Capitol in the manner and the way that those who perpetrated the act, did. Certainly, no one ever expected to see images on the House floor where you're barricading the entrances. So I think everybody's still in a little bit of a state of shock from an emotional standpoint, but also from an intellectual standpoint, understanding how the security at the Capitol complex was so compromised. We have roughly 2,000 Capitol Hill police officers. Clearly, that was nowhere near enough. But I quite candidly never knew you could get through some of the doors and some of the windows that are supposed to be bomb-proof, by the way, as easily as this crowd did. So very, very, very disturbing in every respect.
We can come back to that in a minute, but I do want to ask, we're now in the midst of the second impeachment proceedings in less than 2 years. I mean, what are your thoughts on that today?
Well, this is my general thought. I have never found it to be prudent to have a knee-jerk reaction when you're mad, when you're angry, when emotions are raw. And I think that's really what this translates into. I don't know if there's ever, been been an impeachment of a sitting president where they didn't even have a committee meeting. I mean, they basically no witnesses, no nothing. Just bring it to the floor. And the other component to that, I think it's really bad for the country. Really hurts any opportunity to unite and move forward with this type of action that's being taken. And I think it would be much more prudent to drop the initiative, to recognize that he only has a few more days left in office. Let's get the new president sworn in, and let's move forward as a country. And that'd be a far better outcome for the American people than another impeachment.
Now that you've had some space, I know that you condemn the violence. You called it thuggery. You didn't mince words. Beyond those individuals who are responsible for their own actions, right? Do you think anyone else bears responsibility, whether that's President Trump, media outlets, other politicians?
Yeah, I think this has been brewing for a long time. I don't think there's any specific word that anybody said. I don't think there's any specific sentence necessarily that anybody said. My sense is, after reflecting on all this, regardless of what had been said that day, I think this was pretty well planned by a certain sector, a certain section of that group that came to the rally. You don't suddenly have ropes in your backpack where you're scaling up the walls of the Capitol. You don't, on the spur of the moment, go by Home Depot or Lowe's or wherever else and get the plastic ties, Ziploc ties that you're going to use apparently to subdue members of Congress and their staff in their offices. You don't just accidentally and coincidentally leave those on the minority leader's desk, on the speaker's desk, on the staff desk. The theft of laptops, all of that suggests to me that this was organized. This was planned in advance. And from that perspective, I think if you're going to be objective about it, you have to say, well, that was going to happen anyway. It really doesn't matter who said what, even if their tone was not what it should have been, or perhaps words were somewhat inflammatory. I think this was going to happen anyway. I think it's also important to point out that, you know, language and political discourse, going back to our founding, there's always been fiery language, always been fiery language. I think what's different today is there's an animosity of distrust in some quarters that has been built up over a long period of time, and it ebbed over last Wednesday and resulted in a real tragedy.
Sure. Yeah. And I read your release on the tragedy of January 6th. A couple of strands, if you don't mind, I'd like to pick up there. One, I know it's still an active criminal investigation, and I know better to jump to conclusions, but when we're talking about groups, are we talking about far right groups, far left groups, interest? I mean, I don't know if there are libertarian groups, but I mean, who are we talking about?
That's a great question. We don't really know exactly who we're talking about. To date, there's no sign that it was anybody involved with Antifa that we know about. You know, what we do know suggests more towards white supremacist groups, perhaps. But there's a lot we don't know. You know, it's all speculative. We'll have to see.
And just, I know you've said it before, but just to have it on the record, you said you were disappointed in the president's speech, but also that this has gone back some time. Was there any other moment you felt like the president's rhetoric crossed a line, or was it confined to last Wednesday?
Well, what I would have preferred to see was a more measured tone of realistic expectations. And not just then, but throughout. There's nobody in the Capitol complex, no elected office holder, who believed we were anywhere remotely close to overturning an election. In fact, that wasn't even the prime motive. The motive of this was to highlight the states that were in question, bring attention to all the voting irregularities that stem from changes to election law that were made not by the state legislatures, but were made by individuals, governors, secretary of states, other office holders, and third parties, for example, judges. A very plain reading of the Constitution says that it is only the state legislature that enacts the laws as it relates to an election. Not third parties, not individual governors, not even a state Supreme Court. So that was the crux of the argument, because when you had all these changes that were made in the few weeks and in some cases the few days before Election Day, it leads credence to the thought of people that the election was rigged. And I think that's a big reason why 40% of the American public, according to a recent Reuters poll, specifically says the election, was rigged. That's not healthy for a Democrat Republic, Democratic Republic. That's very corrosive. The whole idea of having a 10-day audit was to give the American people that are in that camp, among that 40%, the understanding that, the understanding basically that, or an audit really of what happened, in those states so that they could have some comfort that the election was legitimate. This really hurts when you got 40% of the country that doesn't believe an election is legitimate. That really hurts President Biden's ability to govern moving forward. And it doesn't help my friends on the Democrat side of the aisle here in Congress either. When people are not certain about the product of the elections in terms of election integrity.
Sure.
So that was the whole point of it, which totally got obfuscated, by the violence of the day and the tragedy.
Right. No, I understand that. Yeah. And I'm familiar with that poll. I think there's some evidence that some of that poll is just longer standing discontent and mistrust of the government, which has probably been amplified. But to the point, I mean, do you feel that Trump's, you've judiciously avoided saying steal, and you've focused on this constitutional issue. Do you feel that some of the tougher rhetoric, right, that we heard from President Trump, was that responsible for this in some way? Because that seems to be what inflamed people's passions. People don't storm the Capitol because there's a constitutional debate. They storm it because they felt something was stolen from them.
Well, you know, when the president uses the term steal, it is reflective upon what a lot of people out there believe. I had friends of mine and constituents of mine who told me before the election, when they were looking at all the changes that were being made in these states, kind of ad hoc on the spur of the moment, you know, that were outside the scope of the legislatures, where you had a secretary of state or you had a governor or you had a group sue the state over mail-in ballots and the procedures, et cetera, and they'd come to a settlement. All that underscored the instinctive belief among many people that the election was going to be stolen. And so, you know, when the president used that term, it was a term that really was reflective of what a lot of people had already thought. Now, where I think he could have done much better is when the legal suits started to be dismissed. And certainly once the Electoral College cast their ballots in December, at that point in time, I think it would have been prudent to tell his supporters, you know, moving forward that, you know, our legal remedies that we sought, although I don't agree with them, you know, those have been tossed. The states have tallied their Electoral College slates, and there's going to be a debate in Washington on the constitutionality of those slates. And whatever the result is on that day, I accept it and look forward to a peaceful transition of power to President Biden and his administration. Yeah. I think that would have been a much better tone, much more appropriate, and much more based in the reality of the facts of the point in time.
Do you think if he had done that, in that measured language, that we would have seen what we saw last week?
I'm not so sure that we wouldn't have seen what we saw last week. Again, we're learning more by the day. But when people show up with ropes in their backpacks and plastic ties, I'm not certain that whatever would have been said on Wednesday, no matter how calm, no matter how measured, no matter what the message was, I'm not sure it would have deterred that. Sure. I think there's a deep-seated anger and distrust. And because keep in mind, they weren't just coming for Speaker Pelosi and those that were violent and criminal. They weren't just coming for the speaker. They were coming for me. They were coming for my Republican colleagues. They were coming for all of us. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. And in their eyes, we are all the enemy. And that is a real issue to deal with moving forward. And it suggests that there's been a major, major breach of confidence and trust at some point in time, whether that was 5 years ago, whether that was 10 years ago, or whether this has been building for 30 years since the Vietnam War.
Let's tap into that, because I think you isolated something really important. A lot of this, the rancor, the divisiveness, the violence, it seems to come from this friction between two or at least two different sets of facts. You know, I'm sure you're aware of the QAnon stuff online, and that's one of 100 conspiracy theories. I don't want to single out one because there's lots.
Sure.
It's very difficult to deal with people. You and I could disagree about stuff, but if we agree on the ground rules, we can get somewhere. But right. In this situation where there are no ground rules and people don't share a common set of underlying facts, is there a fix for that?
Well, again, that goes back to having trust in your institutions, which goes back to the whole point of why we wanted to have that debate, you know, last Wednesday, that quite honestly, you know, was ruined with the violence of the day. You don't fix that overnight. We didn't get here overnight. But I think this is a very important inflection point where we need to come together as best we can and do the necessary things to begin to rebuild trust. And, you know, that goes back to communication. I think all of us moving forward need to be more conscious, you know, about the words that we use, the language that we use, Which is not an easy thing. I mean, everybody in public life makes a gaffe every once in a while. I mean, we do umpteen gazillion interviews. Some days are better than others. You know, we have the same emotional strains and challenges that every other American has. But we've got to, I think, make a good, strong, concerted effort to listen to each other a little more closely. And to get a little better handle on why people feel the way they do in the country on both sides.
Sure.
Both
sides. So if you've got a couple more minutes, I just want to talk about the future then.
Sure.
So one of the things, and I've heard this from, you know, liberal and conservative colleagues alike, is that you still have some pretty profound concerns about the constitutionality of how this election was conducted. But sure. In 61 and a half of 62 cases that Trump and his associates brought in various state courts, conservative and liberal judges alike declined to hear them or rejected them, sometimes quite curtly. Does that make you have concerns about our judicial system? Because it seems to many people that if there was fraud or unconstitutionality, that would have come out in this court process, and it doesn't seem to have worked.
Well, quite candidly, now I have not personally reviewed all the 61, 62, 60 cases that were filed, but I have colleagues who have reviewed them. These are individuals that I served with in Congress who are former U.S. attorneys, they're former assistant U.S. attorneys, they're attorneys by trade. They tell me that they were so shoddily done, misspelled words all over the place, incoherent argument, no detail of fraud or proof of fraud, that just on the surface, just based on how they were presented, on the technicalities, they basically got tossed, which is a great frustration to me and many others who have concerns, because the real true merits of the suits were never given an opportunity really to be heard. But I can totally understand Republican judges and Democrat judges alike looking at a shoddily crafted suit with misspelled words, suits that aren't even becoming of an intern in a law firm. I can understand why they were tossed. And the president has not been well served by those involved in those suits. And I think that's the unfortunate but very honest truth.
Now, one other thing I wanted to tap into that you talked about is, you know, people basically trying to get along a little bit better. And a lot of this friction seems to come from people getting their news from different outlets, and I'm certainly part of that. From your point of view, right, is there anyone who's getting it right who isn't just talking just to the people in their own silos?
Well, I'm a big fan of our minority leader, Kevin McCarthy. He has incredible interpersonal communication skills. He and Steny Hoyer have been good friends for a long time. The majority leader on the House side, Steny Hoyer's Democrat from Maryland, been around for a long time. The problem that we have in today's world is you have a 24-hour news service. You have all these different cable outlets. Everybody is basically in their own cocoon watching their favorite TV personality. All these shows are based on ratings. Well, what drives ratings? Conflict, fiery language, somebody's not doing right and, you know, they're not conservative enough or they're not liberal enough so you have a steady diet of this, over a long period of time. And I don't blame any of the talk show hosts. I don't blame the cable networks. I don't think there's any singular point of blame for any of this. It's the environment that we're in. I mean, it's the ocean that we swim in these days, and none of us control those currents. But we have to deal, with the undertow of those currents. And, I just think as a whole, it all gets back to each individual And not only just elected members of Congress or other elected officials, but each of us individually in our homes, you know, what are we consuming? What is our mind consuming on a daily basis? What are the minds of our children consuming on a daily basis? You know, is it healthy or is it unhealthy? Is it adding to the coarseness of the discourse in this country, or is it improving the discourse in this country? All you have to do is look on anybody's Facebook page who is an elected leader, and you see things that, at least when I was growing up, you know, I would have had my butt whipped if I wrote those things, even if I thought those things, and there was some idea that I was thinking on, I would have had my butt whipped. You know, so I think that gets back, honestly, I think that gets back to the moral and spiritual decline of the country, which is an individual issue. It's a family issue. It's a church issue. Washington, D.C. is nothing more than a microcosm of society. And I think that's an important point to understand.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, and he's not alone, but the President of the United States has definitely said and tweeted things that would have had my mouth washed out with soap.
Yeah, and you know, I love my friends from New York, but I have been a witness to things said and done towards each other among New Yorkers that I would never see in North Carolina. Yeah. You know, it's a different, and that's not a knock on anybody against anybody from New York. But you know, the mannerisms, how they talk, you know, what's on their mind, the way they say it, you know, is a little more upfront, than, genteel North Carolina.
So if I think, you know, the president's critics would decry me for being too generous here, but let's call it political style. The president's political style, is that something the GOP imagines it would stick with? Because it's been incredibly successful despite losing the election. Over 70 million people still voted for President Trump. So sure. Is that something that's still in the GOP's toolkit, that kind of fiery rhetoric, or are you looking for something more genteel in North Carolina in the White House in, say, 2024?
Well, I think it's important to understand that, you know, President Trump connected with the average person in a real way. You know, he was willing to say some of the things that a lot of people thought but wouldn't necessarily say. You know, he was willing to stand up and do the things that he had campaigned on, such as moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's the first president ever to campaign on it, but then not only campaign on it, actually do it. He created a great deal of goodwill and trust among his support base, because he spoke their language. He knew how to communicate with them, and he did what he said he would do. And he had a different style, different way of going about business. But quite frankly, that's where the country was in 2016. They didn't want the president's typical style of usual, referring to previous presidents, Bush and his father and Clinton and even Reagan. You know, they wanted somebody to come to D.C. Because they had begun to distrust D.C. in a major way. They want somebody to come up here, turn over the tables, and make these institutions responsive and accountable to the American public. You know, not this distant, faraway land where, policies are being enacted that they don't agree with.
And I think even critics of the president would. There are definitely Democrats and libertarians and unaffiliated voters who also feel that way. Is there a danger in going too far? In obviously the president's supporters are incredibly loyal to him personally. Can that go too far when a president says things that are, you know, occasionally misleading or unfounded? Is there a check on that we need?
Well, you know, President Trump supporters are very independent minded people. You know, they recognize he has flaws. They recognize everybody has flaws. You know, the two comments I would always hear throughout the last 4 years is, David, you Republicans need to do more to support the president. And by the way, tell him to quit tweeting so much. tell him to tone it down. And so they recognize that, you know, he just as all of us, you know, we all have our faults. He has his faults, but they appreciated what he was trying to do. And because he was fulfilling the commitments that he had made, it earned him a long leash. You know, people were willing to tolerate some of the personality aspects that they didn't really like. I can't tell you again, I can't tell you how many times people would say, make sure Republicans support the president more. And by the way, tell him to tone it down.
Right. So, I mean, all right. So last question about the president. What do you think January 6th does to his legacy? I mean, for people, I mean, it's happening in Congress right now. People are accusing him of inciting an insurrection. Is that?
One of the big tragedies of that day, from a standpoint of the Trump family, from the standpoint of all the accomplishments that he was a part of, that he was really the leader of, and quite frankly, would not have happened without him. Standing up to China, utilizing tariffs to equal the trade imbalances. You know, he was a very consequential president. The tax cuts and the regulatory reforms and sticking with Supreme Court nominees, even when it got difficult, such as the Kavanaugh nomination, standing by him until the end, until he gets confirmed. Any other president would have pulled his nomination and started again, given the nature of that debate and where it looked at the time. So many successes in so many ways, and yet it's all stained by January the 6th. It really is a modern day political tragedy.
Yeah.
On its own right.
So last question, because I know you've got tons to do. In a couple of weeks, it'll be, you know, the Congress operating under the new Biden administration. Obviously, those wounds in Congress and in the nation aren't going to heal overnight. But are there things on the table right now that Congress can get going on and work on now?
Well, and that's the other problem with this impeachment that we're going to be voting on, apparently, as of tomorrow. All this does is divide the country that much more. And when President-elect Biden gets sworn in on January the 20th, it's going to be front and center. It's not the way, as a new president, you're going to want to start out. You know, in order to get things done, even though they have a majority technically in the U.S. Senate, with Kamala Harris breaking the ties, and of course, you know, it's going to be dead even, but she'll break the ties. So technically they have a majority. You still have to get 60 votes in the Senate to do most things. And he's going to have bipartisan cooperation. In the House, there's a much tighter margin for Speaker Pelosi. And so it's not going to be as easy for her either to push forward strict party line measures that only have the support of the hard left wing component of her caucus. I think the president elect would do well to come forward with a bipartisan infrastructure proposal for the country. We need infrastructure funding for roads and bridges, for our water and sewer needs. Broadband deployment is a major issue in rural North Carolina and all throughout rural America, especially in this day and age of COVID, from an education standpoint for our children that need it in order to hook to the internet to complete their coursework and continue to learn, for telemedicine and a whole variety of healthcare needs. To rebuild the economy. No one's going to bring a business to an area that doesn't have good access to the internet. So all those things as part of a major infrastructure initiative should attract, if done appropriately, should attract a significant amount of bipartisan support and would be an excellent way to begin to move forward and help to reinstill in the American public confidence that, you know, Congress can do things.
Yeah. So 4 years ago, you and I spoke about replacing the Affordable Care Act with something better. that obviously people didn't enjoy the mandate, and there were other issues with it. You know, is that going to be a casualty of the law? Obviously, we didn't expect what the coming 4 years were going to be like, but do you think tackling healthcare is going to be a victim of partisan divide, or is that anywhere on the horizon?
Well, a lot of modifications were made to the Affordable Care Act by the Trump administration because the way the law was written, it provided the Secretary of Health and Human Services wide latitude on implementation of a lot of those provisions. And so the Trump administration moved forward with things such as associated health plans, you know, things that would allow for a little more competition and availability of variety for consumers, you know, in need of a better healthcare plan, help to de-escalate the cost, a lot of these changes that they made. And so we'll see what this administration does, what the Biden administration does to those administrative changes that were made. I think healthcare is going to continue to be a major issue. I'm among a study group among House Republicans that have been working on our alternatives to what we have in law now, providing for more transparency, for more competition, more choice, less regulatory burden for the doctors and our hospitals. But it's a real challenge because it's complicated. And anything that is complicated also gets emotional, and healthcare is a very emotional subject. So between the complication of the issue and the emotional aspect of the issue, it makes it very difficult to deal with and make major change politically. So I don't foresee any major change, certainly not in this Congress with the Affordable Care Act. I think it's just going to be a question of how many of the modifications that the Trump administration made are going to be kept by this new administration.
Fair enough. Well, you've given us so much of your time. I'm very grateful. Thank you so much. Anything else you'd want to tell people before I let you go at last?
Well, I think we probably exhausted it pretty good here. But very nice to visit with you, and appreciate the opportunity to chat. It was a good interview.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Have a good night.